To Matthew chapter 6. So it's page 918. Should bring you to Matthew. For those of you who are visiting or haven't been around for a while, we're currently focusing upon a series here at the Mission on the most famous sermon ever preached, which is called the Sermon on the Mount. And Sermon on the Mount comes in the Gospel of Matthew, chapters 5 to 7. And at the moment we're halfway through chapter 6, so we're going to be carrying on doing this series up to just before Christmas. Now, something just about this Sermon on the Mount, this teaching that Jesus gives here, this sermon, a lot of people just know bits of it, but what I want to say is it's not like a collection of pithy sayings that are all bundled nicely together. Rather, the whole sermon is a flowing, logical presentation of actually what it means to be a follower of Jesus and what a lifestyle that shows our priority is actually the kingdom of God rather than just living for ourselves should actually look like. And the thing about Sermon on the Mount, there are so many challenges in this sermon. I think it's really a challenging sermon. So when people say, oh, if we all lived like the Sermon on the Mount, life would be great. Well, it would be, but like it's really hard to live by this teaching. And this is particularly true of today's teaching in verses 19 to 24. Now, this is a key pivot in the sermon as a whole. In the first 18 verses of chapter 6, Jesus has spoken, if you like, about the danger of empty outward religion, where everything is done just to impress people and for show. But when we do things just for show, that is, if you like, the enemy of genuine inward faith. And then from verses 19 to 34, Jesus speaks of two other very dangers to our spiritual well-being, which are these. One is wealth, and the other is worry. Wealth and worry. What, if you like, they both have in common is worldliness. And by that, I mean when our focus shifts from God and all that he promises and living for him instead to the God of this age. We think about wealth this week and we think about worry next week. But actually they're both part of one block of teaching from Jesus. But we haven't got time this morning to look at it all. So this week we're going to look at the dangers of wealth and how it can affect our walk with God. And next week we think about worry and how that can really affect our walk with God. Okay, so if I'm going to get us thinking about wealth, we need to begin by considering our attitude to money. Now, we don't like to talk about money, do we? Do we? People tend to not talk about money. We tend to think money is a very personal subject. Interesting thing is, Jesus spoke a great deal about money. There are 38 parables in the Gospels. 16 deal with money either directly or by as a way of an illustration. In Matthew, Mark and Luke, the Gospels there, one in every six verses is about money. So if we avoid thinking about this, then we do at our spiritual peril. Now, when it comes to money, this is my experience. My experience is that our natural inclination, including myself in this, I have to stand here and say that, is to actually want or a sense feel that we need just that little bit more than we've actually got. Regardless of how much we've got, we've always got this sense we could just do with a little bit more. Maybe on my own in that, but that's often how I feel. I think one of the problems we all have when it comes to the teaching in the New Testament on money and wealth is that we never tend to classify ourselves as being rich. So in that you didn't really need a sermon after that kid's bit, did you? That great story about the camel and everything, that was very profound. That story came when Jesus was talking to a rich young man, and you read that story and you always think, well, I'm not like that, I'm not rich. But in a global and historical sense, we are rich. We are rich. Defining and measuring poverty is very complex, but the World Bank estimates that in 2011, where we are now, 1.1 billion people live on less than $1 a day. 2.7 billion people live on less than $2 a day. Now, I would expect, and I suppose I'd guess, that all of us here are relatively very, very rich compared to those 2.7 billion people who live on less than $2 a day. Here's just one little statistic. To own even one book, sets you instantly in the global privileged minority. Nevertheless, we never quite appreciate that we are rich, because our attention is often guided, isn't it, by envy. We look to those people who are richer than we are. And if we could let generosity rather than envy direct our attention and focus, it would go the other way, and we would be aware actually of how privileged and how much we have. But despite our relative wealth, I want to suggest that if we're honest, we would all like that little bit more than we have. I'm not going to ask you to put your hand up here, but ask it in your own heart. If you would think, I'd all like just a little bit more. And, you know, you'll probably say to yourself, I don't necessarily want the finest car. I don't want the holiday of a lifetime. Whatever you may daydream about at points. I think our desire for more wealth is about something much more profound and deep than just wanting something. If I had that, I'd be happy. I think it's all about our desire for security. We want to know we're going to be okay for the future. We actually want to be in control of what's going to happen to us. And with this in mind, the teaching in this section in verses 19 to 34 is actually the teaching Jesus gives is much, much more than just money. It's about our basic attitude to life. It's about the deep desires that are in our hearts. It's about actually who or what we choose to worship and what we choose to give ourselves to. So at the outset of the teaching on wealth and worry, the question I think Jesus is asking is not how much have you got, but rather, who do you serve? Who do you serve? Where is your heart? He's asking where our hope and trust is really rooted. So we're going to look at verses 19 to 24 and going to look at it in three little bits. And after each little bit, I'm going to ask a question. So the first section is 19 to 21. And the question is, where is your treasure? This is what the question I'm not asking you. This is the question Jesus is asking. So let me read you verses 19 to 21. Do not store up for yourselves treasure on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will also be. Now, this is a profound teaching here. I want us to think about this. When it comes to treasure, Jesus asks us to consider what the treasure actually is, how long it will last, and to weigh up its comparative durability. So if you had a choice between two treasures, say you were offered two treasures, wouldn't you go not only for what is valuable, but what will last? That's what makes treasure treasure, and it's something that will last. Now, what Jesus does here, he wants us to consider how all material things, all those things that Brendan put up when he put those things, you know, that whatever it is, all material things are doomed to fade or rot or corrode or decay or get burned or get broken or get stolen or get lost. Everything material is under threat in some way. If you can tell me one material thing that is totally, totally secure, please tell me afterwards, because I couldn't think of one. I've sat there for a long time thinking about this. I can think of one. If you can think of one, come and talk to me afterwards. Here's an article I kept in a paper which underlined this point very painfully for this guy, but very poignantly, I think, as well. The article has a headline, "Who Stole My House?" And it says, "Rip-out raiders took roof, stairs, floors, doors, and yes, the kitchen sink went too." in this article, it says about how this guy, he had a mock 1920s Tudor house worth millions. And over a three-day period, off came the roof, 6,000 square feet of oak flooring, two hand-built Inglenook brick fireplaces, the oak panelling, the fitted kitchen, all the skirting boards and all the doors, including the front door with its stone surround, so he didn't need a key when he came back. The owner who was renovating it all, he was renovating this house to sell it on, said this in the article. He said, Mr. Turnsey yesterday offered a £5,000 reward for information leading to the capture of the gang who did it. And he said he'd previously been the victim of theft on a smaller scale. He said, well, I've had patios and fireplaces taken, you know, something you put in a van or a wheelbarrow, but we've actually never had the whole house taken, he added. A whole house. Now, that's an extreme example, but I think what it underlines, doesn't it, that every earthly treasure is vulnerable. And it really, logically, it emphasises that if your heart's desire is to stockpile material things here on earth, and then you expect them to bring you happiness, security and fulfilment, it will prove elusive. But the pressure is constantly on to buy into the belief that the more we have, the happier we will be. Just to buy into that equation. The more I have, the happier I'll be. Advertisers feed on the must-have mentality, in that adverts are generally designed to make us discontent with what we have and increase the desire for more. And it's so powerful, isn't it? It's so persuasive. One historian wrote this: advertising has changed the way that we think and act. We have gone from caveman and cavewoman to craveman and cravewoman. It's a bit corny, but anyway. But what exactly is Jesus warning against here? I think we need to really think about this. When he says don't store up treasure on earth, it doesn't mean we never make any provision for the future. Jesus is not prohibiting material possessions in themselves or prohibiting the enjoyment of good things. It's much more to do with our hearts and our affections than our possessions. What he does, he warns us against the selfish accumulation of treasure. He's prohibiting that materialism that, if you like, tethers our hearts to this earth, and the hard-heartedness that can often come with that, that just ignores the colossal need that we have around us. Logically, whatever treasure we have on earth is corruptible. It cannot be totally protected, and ultimately we cannot take it with us at the end. The question, how much did they leave when someone dies, is actually the same answer for everyone, everywhere, every time. Because the answer is, of course, everything. That's what you leave when you die. Naked I came out of my mother's womb, naked I shall return, declared Job many years ago. And it's an unavoidable fact. Jesus then tells us to compare treasure on earth with treasure in heaven. What did he mean by that phrase? What is treasure in heaven? And how do we store it? Now, I'll tell you this, that's really worth thinking on and discussing. I've often thought about this, and I'd like you, if afterwards you have some tea or coffee, or this afternoon you're sitting there, ask that question: what is treasure in heaven? What does it actually look like? How do we store it? Let me give you, right, my understanding is, to lay up treasure in heaven is to invest our time and our energy and our money into that where the effect and the fruit will last beyond the here and now, but will last into eternity. Let's always be mindful that God is concerned much, much more about our character, who we are, than our comfort, what we have. We know from the New Testament that his will for every one of us is to be transformed into the image of Christ. We're also told in the New Testament, and we know this, that everything in the end will pass away. Everything will pass away. Except we're told three things will remain. Now here's a question just to keep you awake, okay? When the New Testament says three things will remain, what are those three things? brilliant. Faith, hope, love. Paul said everything will pass away, but these three things actually will remain. But they're not sort of tangible, material kinds. You can't get hold of faith, can you, or love, or hope. So what will remain is what God has worked in me. And just consider how faith, hope and love always take me out of myself. They deliver me from self-love, from self-seeking. They deliver me from worldliness. All the time I give myself to those things that deepen my faith, that increase my hope, that express the love of Christ within me. That is like storing up treasure in heaven that will last. John Stott, who died this summer, wrote a great commentary on the Sermon on the Mount. Recommend it. But he wrote this in his commentary. He described treasure in heaven thus: it is those things that are temporal activities but have eternal consequences. Now, I think that's a great definition, very simple one. It's those things that are temporal, we do, but with eternal consequences. Let's discern what they are, and let's invest our lives well by doing them. Okay, second section is verses 22 and 23. And here the question is, where is your focus? Jesus goes on to say this: the eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Now, Jesus now moves from the treasure in our hearts, he's thinking about our hearts, and he talks now about the focus of our eyes. Two illustrations. Let's be clear and say this. In Scripture, to set your heart on something and to fix your eyes upon something is really the same thing, the language that's used. Just as what is in our hearts will show in how we invest our time and our energy, so where we fix our eyes, spiritually speaking, will show what drives and motivates us. Jesus says something interesting. He says, the eye is the lamp of the body. What did he mean by that? Well, everything by and large which the body does depends on our ability to see. Our eyes, if you like, they move, they guide our movement and activity. The eye illumines what the body does through its hands and its feet. Where we fix our eyes spiritually, that's what Jesus is trying to get us to think about, affects the whole of our life. Now, the writer to the Hebrews tells us that in the race that's marked out before us, in this journey that we're on, which is a tough race, it's a long race, it's a difficult one, it requires determination, it requires discipline, we are told to fix our eyes upon who? Jesus. That's what he says. He said, fix your eyes, where? Upon Jesus. Why? Well, then he tells us, he says, because he's the author and the perfecter of our faith. In other words, he has shown us how to endure, how to persevere. And actually, Jesus also shows us that there is a reward for those who follow him, and it awaits us. I read an article by Jackie Pullinger, who many of you will know works among addicts in Hong Kong in a very tough and demanding ministry. And one way she's able to keep doing this over a very long period, it's over 20, 30 years, is this. She said in this interview, God has given me resurrection eyes. That's what she said. Good phrase. Just to quote, she says, he's given me eyes that are able to focus on the risen, living Lord Jesus Christ. All who believe in their hearts and hope in the resurrection of the dead know that their destination is a place of comfort, is a better country, is a heavenly city. And this is my spiritual focus. Now, it's not only significant where we focus our eyes, spiritually speaking, but also, I think, how can I put this, how we see. By that, I mean this. How do we actually see the world around us? How do we see people who we meet daily? Do we look lustfully, enviously, cynically at others? When we look at what we have, do we actually focus more on what we don't have and what we would like? Or do we look through the eyes of Christ? Do we let him determine the perspective by which we see others, by which we see ourselves, by which we see what we actually have in this life. Because the reality is, we can look at the same situation and see two completely different things, can't we? Isn't it so easy to look and see a reason to be envious, to be cynical, to be critical? But let's be challenged. I don't think that's looking through the eyes of Christ. Let's be challenged to look and see the reasons instead to be thankful, to be encouraging, and to be gracious. One, I believe, is a sign of walking in the light. The other is walking in darkness. And it's interesting, we're called to be people of the light of the day and not in the night. So much about how we react to what's going on in our lives is how we see things. Let's think on that. Final part, third contrast, if you like, Jesus gives. He's got treasures on earth, treasures in heaven. He's got, you've either got eyes that are full of light or eyes that are full of darkness. And now we come on to the third one, and it's in verse 24. Let me read it. No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Now, the contrast that Jesus highlights now is between two masters. And the question really he's asking is this: who do you serve? Whom do you serve? He uses very strong language in making this contrast. He says you're either going to love or you hate. You'll be devoted or you'll despise. It's one or the other. And I think what Jesus is doing, he's saying that undivided loyalty that any God would demand. And he says, clearly, you cannot serve both God and money. Now, interesting here, money is a translation of the Greek word mammon. And in some older translations, people would maybe know this as you can't serve God and mammon. But now we say God and money. But there is an important context here, okay? The original people hearing this would have understood it maybe in a different way. Mammon was the god of wealth in Carthage, which was the capital of Roman Africa. Mammon is translated money here, which is perceptive because it does, actually money does have all the characteristics of a pagan god, in that it does seem to offer us freedom, it seems to offer us power, influence, status, prestige. And the reality is, it is capable, isn't it, of inspiring devotion. And to get lots of money, for some people, what it requires is a single-minded devotion and preoccupation to get there. Here's a quote from someone called Richard Foster. He wrote a book called Power, Sex and Money, and this is what he just said about money. I found this helpful. It says, when the Bible refers to money as power, it doesn't mean something vague or impersonal. Nor does it mean power in the sense we may mean when we speak of purchasing power. According to Jesus and the writers of the New Testament, behind money is a very real spiritual force that energizes it and gives it a power of its own. Hence, money is an active agent. It has a power unto its own and is capable of inspiring devotion. And aren't we all aware it does have enormous pull and power, doesn't it, money? Enormous. And Paul the Apostle was not exaggerating when he said, the love of money is the root of all evil. That's what he said. That is, the love of money is the root of all evil. Not money is the root of all evil. That's really misquoted. People sometimes say, oh, well, money is the root of all evil. No, it's the love of money which is the root of all evil. Because the love of money not only draws our focus and energy away from what is eternal, it also has the power to strangle our devotion to God. And in the end, if we are devoted to one, it is inevitable we will come to despise the other. In the Borneo rainforest, there's a very strange kind of tree that's known as the strangler fig tree. Has anyone heard of the strangler fig tree? No? No one's heard of the strangler fig tree? It does exist, okay? Google it. If you have a computer, Google the strangler fig tree. It's really fascinating what it says about it, okay? Doesn't sound very nice, does it? This is why it's called the strangler fig tree. Birds carry seeds from the tree, from this tree that are on the floor of the rainforest, and they carry the seeds up to the canopy at the top where they're exposed to the light. And some of these seeds manage to take root in the canopy of the tree. So if you can imagine the foliage at the top, the seed goes up, starts to grow, and it starts to take root in the canopy of the tree. The roots then grow down into the trunk of the host, and they bed into the soil at the bottom. As the years go by, these roots go stronger and stronger and thicker. Gradually, the roots wrap around the host tree, completely around it. And the fig's crown grows foliage, which overshadows the host tree. So eventually, the host tree is entrapped in a prison cell of roots, which deprives it of any light whatsoever. Now, if you deprive a tree of light, what happens to it? It dies. It eventually dies, leaving the strangler fig tree with a hollow trunk in between. So in the end, you can see a picture of it. It's just it's these huge roots that are growing up, and the tree has died inside. I think it's a striking illustration that we can connect with this teaching of Jesus, this warning about not loving money. And it's this: if money becomes our God, if money becomes the thing that we become devoted to, then as sure as the roots and shoots of the strangler fig tree will suffocate the life out of the host tree, so the love of money will do exactly the same to our spiritual life. Be aware, it can start relatively small, but it is able to grow into something big and powerful enough to dominate our lives, dictate all our priorities, and it will suffocate our devotion to God. And Jesus highlights a serious spiritual danger which we must take very seriously. The danger arises because of the material things that surround us. And ultimately, the danger is that we might become devoted to money, devoted to possessions, and the power that they bring. And that will inevitably replace the love that we have for the Lord our God. And I say that it's a tragedy. In the end, you will come to despise the things of God. Let's be clear what this teaching is not saying. This teaching is not saying that wealth in itself is sinful. It's not saying that temporal things are to be avoided. No, it's not saying that. What Jesus is highlighting is the inordinate affection that we may have towards those things that the Lord Jesus is clearly warning us against. And let me say this: a divided, compromised heart is the blight of the soul, and it can destroy us from the inside out. I read a story recently about someone who had a really strange medical diagnosis. This person had a really painful foot. Walking was increasingly difficult, and so a doctor's help. He went to the doctor and asked for help. X-rays were taken. Special shoes were given to him and worn, but nothing gave him any relief, and his pain in his foot was getting worse. One day, a mutual friend happened to mention that he had heard of a similar case and suggested that the cause was actually a bad tooth. But no toothache had occurred with this man, but he thought he'd try because he was getting desperate, so he went to the dentist. X-rays were taken, and a small abscess was found just below the tooth that somehow connected with his nervous system that went down to his foot. A proper procedure by the dentist brought immediate relief to the man's foot, and it's never hurt since, by taking this abscess out. And I want to say this: if we're feeling far from God, if we're drifting and feeling an increasing distance maybe from other Christian believers, if our desire for fellowship and service is diminishing, the reason for that is not usually something outward, something that's happening to us from the outside. The cause is something inward, and it's something hidden from other people, because it's got to do with the devotion of our heart. And Jesus spells out very clearly that you cannot love God and you cannot love the world at the same time. So, don't try and do the impossible. No one before you has succeeded, and neither will you. You have to choose one or the other. So to finish, I think we need a reminder of what Jesus declared as being the greatest commandment. And it was simply this: love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbour as you love yourself. And in light of the greatest commandment, the message from Jesus is very clear, and it's this: deal drastically with any inordinate affection in your soul for the things of the world before it deals a death blow to your love for God and leaves you an eternal pauper. And if worldliness, like those roots from the strangler fig tree, are suffocating, if you like, the spiritual reality within you, reducing your Christian faith to becoming one of just convenience and compromise, then press the alarm button today and begin to deal with it. Where is your treasure? Where is your spiritual focus? Who do you serve? Those three questions that Jesus gave in the Sermon on the Mount are actually all about the devotion of our hearts. And the key to responding positively and properly to these questions is what? It's to fix our eyes upon Jesus. He alone has loved us with an everlasting love. He has shown that. He has proved it by choosing to go and die for us. And in light of that amazing love, get rid of any idols, for they will do nothing for your souls except bring disillusionment and ultimately, we're told, if we give ourselves to other idols, destruction. But instead, fix your eyes upon Jesus. Because there, when you do that, you see the grace and the mercy and the love of God in all its abundance. And we need to allow the realization of that touch our hearts afresh. Amen.